We have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish and Maria Tomchick, both with the state. Good morning.
Good morning.
Morning.
All right. Lots to cover as usual, starting out with local and the Washington State Supreme Court.
Yeah, this week the Washington State Supreme Court came back with a ruling on school funding in the state of Washington. They decided 7-2 that the state must fully fund education, and it has until 2018 to get its act together. Now, I want to just point out that this is a follow-on of a 1978 ruling by the same court that said the state had to define what a basic education is in the state of Washington and provide the funding for it for all students in the state. And of course, that effort didn't go very far. So what I find kind of interesting is that the state legislature is going to be convening here on Monday to start its 60-day session where it has to discuss how to plug a couple billion dollars of a hole in the state budget. And, of course, first on the table is going to be education cuts that amount to hundreds of millions of dollars, including probably about $25 million for the Seattle School District. And clearly the legislature and the governor aren't getting the message, because Governor Gregoire late last year proposed an all cuts state budget, including these big cuts to education, and then later proposed a 0.5% sales tax increase to try to, quote unquote, buy back some of those cuts.
Yeah.
Knowing, of course, that raising revenue during a recession is one of the hardest things you can get a state legislature to do.
And well, particularly with the two-thirds requirement in place from Tim Eymond's initiative. And
Gregoire, which is going through a court challenge right now.
Yes, it's going through a court challenge. And Gregoire mentioned also that she's going to take a separate query on the constitutionality of I-1053, which is the Eymond initiative, directly to the Washington State Supreme Court, bypassing an advisory ruling from Rob McKenna, who, of course, politically supports
right.
Tim Eymond. The other thing that was interesting about the Washington State Supreme Court ruling is that the state Supreme Court is going to retain jurisdiction over the case to continue to try and enforce it. It's very similar to a court that puts a corrupt union into receivership.
Yeah, very
and
similar.
So what's going to happen with this is that as the state legislature decides what cuts to make in the budget over the next 60 days, you know, the state Supreme Court is going to retain the right to step in and say, no, you can't do that.
Yeah, that's not sufficient funding for education.
And so there is going to be a hammer over the state Supreme state legislature in their deliberations on this.
All right. Moving on. Governor Gregoire coming out this week, the press conference.
Yeah, she had a press conference this week saying that, yes, she will, after 7 years, finally allow the sponsors of a bill that supports gay marriage, that would allow for gay marriage in the state of Washington. She will allow the sponsors of that bill to put her name on the bill as well. Every year, Senator Ed...
That's mighty decent.
Oh, I know. Every year, Senator Ed Murray introduces this bill, and it pretty much goes nowhere, partly because the Democratic Party in the state of Washington can't get their act together and get behind it. And, of course, the governor, being a Democrat, should be the leader of the state Democratic Party. And for 7 years, she's been slacking on this issue.
Yeah.
And now that she's not looking at running again for re-election, she's finally decided that it's safe for her to support gay marriage.
Yeah, between her coming out and saying that she would belatedly but still positively support this, and her willingness to challenge after a couple of years the Eymond initiative, it seems like Gregoire has finally noticed that she's not running for re-election next year, and she can actually afford to do things that might annoy some people, and, you know, exercise leadership, that kind of a thing.
It's a little late.
It's very late, but better late than never.
Yeah,
I guess.
All right. Moving on, Boeing ruffling some feathers this week.
Yeah, Boeing decided to close its Wichita, Kansas facility. Of course, Wichita, along with St. Louis and Seattle, major hubs of Boeing's facilities for many, many years. It's going to close its Wichita facility and move most of its operations from Wichita to either Oklahoma City or San Antonio. Of course, the Wichita facilities being unionized and the Oklahoma and Texas facilities not being unionized is a major factor behind this move. And this move comes because, in spite of the fact that Boeing has made numerous promises to local and state lawmakers in Kansas over the years that it would stay in Wichita, and as a result result of those promises, or as a condition of those promises, has received literally millions and millions of dollars in tax credits, tax exemptions, loopholes, etc. It's taken that money and it's running. And so when you hear Boeing saying, as it has this week, that some of those jobs might come to the Puget Sound area, no, it's the other way around. Boeing is doing everything possible to eliminate its union jobs, and it's going to try and eliminate its union jobs in Puget Sound also. Watch for it.
And we should keep that in mind with the legislature convening on Monday, that businesses are going to be lining up to preserve the tax breaks and the revenue cuts and so forth.
Preserve nothing. They want to expand them.
Oh, yeah. As much as they possibly can. You know, they're going to say we need to create more jobs, and the way to create more jobs is tax cuts, tax cuts, tax cuts, when Boeing doesn't pay its fair share right now. And I wouldn't count on it preserving jobs here
and
in
those
the Puget
Sound
area.
And those are the local taxes. Bear in mind also, federally, Boeing paid no taxes at all in 2010.
Yeah, and it's not as if they've been suffering either. The Boeing company has been very, very profitable, particularly over the last decade with two U.S. wars going on simultaneously.
Yeah, their military has been, wing has been extremely profitable over the last decade. Of course, military procurement has been a boom business in this country for the last, 200 years.
All right. Well, speaking of which, moving on to national, starting out with
President... Did I really say boom business?
You did.
He did.
President Obama and a new national security strategy?
Yes, Obama announcing this week a new strategy that disavows for the first time in about 15 years the Pentagon's desire to have the might on hand to simultaneously win two major regional wars. That's been a cornerstone of U.S. military policy since the Clinton era, 1995 or so. Obama is saying instead that he will seek cuts in the Defense Department's spending, those cuts in line, of course, with the cuts that were mandated when the super committee failed to meet its budget reduction goals in late November last year. Nonetheless, this is a positive step. The step down on this is the military, rather than having the capacity to win two wars, now, this is the direct quote, must be able to fight one war, but is responsible only for denying the objectives of or imposing unacceptable costs on an opportunistic aggressor in a second region. Now, this is not much of a step down. It certainly isn't challenging the imperial assumptions of U.S. military and foreign policy, but it is certainly a step in the right direction. Unfortunately, of course, this also came the same week after this past weekend when Obama signed into law the National Defense Authorization Act that abolished habeas corpus and due process for suspected terrorists, saying that those would be tried in military court and at the discretion of the executive branch with no particular oversight or checks and balances and no right to for those accused of such crimes to have a day in court or defend themselves. It also
or even to see the evidence against them.
Or even to see the evidence against them. It all of which is supposedly, you know, guaranteed by the Constitution. It also raised the bar substantially on the barriers that are now in place to keep a Guantanamo facility from closing, coming up this week on the 10th anniversary of the opening of Guantanamo. And that, of course, was a promise of Obama in 2008 to close that facility. And partially at Obama's behest, partially at Congress's, that has not happened. But Obama signing that into law this week, it concerns a lot of civil liberties advocates, and it's sort of a microcosm of what's been the problem with the Obama administration for the last 4 years. He does something abominable, like abolishing habeas corpus, and then he does something that's a minor step in the right direction in terms of stepping down the U.S. national security strategy. It's two steps back and one step forward, and it's been like that for, 3.5 years.
All right. Well, sticking with actions by President Obama, multiple recess appointments this week.
Yeah, one of the recess appointments this week was the Office of Financial Research finally got a director. This office, a lot of people are saying, what does the Office of Financial Research do? Well, you might have heard of the Financial Stability Oversight Council, which is supposed to help foresee and avert another crisis that could bring down the entire financial system. Well, the Financial Stability and Oversight Council would rely on the Office of Financial Research to accumulate all the data necessary and then crunch the numbers to figure out where the risks are in our financial system.
Well, we wouldn't want to prevent another financial meltdown. That might crimp some people's style.
We wouldn't want anyone to be able to see where the risks are, the major risks are in the financial system, because that tends to be where most of the profits are being made. Now, the director of that agency is someone who has to handle tons of data, and a really good candidate would have been Robert Shiller, the guy who developed the Case-Shiller Home Price Index, because he would know more than anybody how to gather huge amounts of data and how to crunch the numbers. But he decided not to. He was interviewed for the job, but he decided not to do it because Republicans in Congress have been trying since the passage of Dodd-Frank in 2010 to abolish,
which created this
agency and the Financial Stability Oversight Council too. They've been trying since the passage of Dodd-Frank to abolish these agencies. And he decided, well, you know, just in my personal life, I probably wouldn't pass scrutiny by Congress. And it's a pretty high bar when you have members of Congress, powerful members of Congress, saying, oh, these agencies shouldn't exist, much less should this guy be director. So finally, Obama had to do through a recess appointment someone named Richard Berner, who is a former chief economist for Morgan Stanley, of course, somebody with banking industry experience. And it's not clear that that he has the ability to do what someone like Robert Shiller would do, which is be able to get a handle on the huge amounts of data that are going to be required to help the Office of Financial, help the Financial Stability Oversight Council do their job.
Yeah, we also saw Richard Cordray appointed to head the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, another agency created by Dodd-Frank and another agency opposed by Republicans. And the Republicans have been doing everything in their power to block the appointments of anybody to staff these agencies that they oppose.
Regulatory agencies.
Regulatory agencies, exactly. And they are likely to mount a court challenge on the recess appointments based on the fact that they've been having, as a minority, mind you, they're not the folks that convene the Senate because the Democrats have the majority in the Senate, but they've been trying to keep the Senate open by having Republicans come in, pound a gavel, and then 3 seconds later pound a gavel again and claiming that the Senate was open for business on that day as a result. There being nothing in the Constitution, of course, saying that how long the Senate has to be in business in order to it not be eligible for a recess appointment. And that's the claim that the Republicans are making, is that this sham operation of the Senate with no quorum in attendance, no members of the majority party in attendance,
it means that there's not really a recess.
Exactly. And that's the position of the Obama administration. This is going to be settled in court as a result. So it's likely to be a while before these folks are actually able to even be considered by the, or actually able to step in and do their new jobs. And we should mention also that the definition of a recess appointment is that it's good only for 1 year. And so within that year, the Senate still has to come back and consider
approving these nominations. So even if these guys get a chance to start work in their new jobs, they're only going to be there for a year probably, because getting the Republicans on board to approve them as director of these agencies is going to be, like I said, a steep uphill battle.
Yeah, they're likely to be filibustered.
All right. Also this week, developments regarding the SEC.
Yeah, the Securities and Exchange Commission announcing yesterday that it would no longer allow defendants to say they neither admit nor deny civil fraud nor insider trading charges. Now, this is something that we've talked about on this show, where in a lot of cases with these large corporations where they get hauled in on civil cases or even criminal cases, the SEC has been settling with them in exchange for sealing the case, that is, judges not being able to even see what the charges were against them, and with the company not saying whether they not admitting any wrongdoing. We talked, of course, in late November about Judge Jed Rakoff in Manhattan blasting the settlement with Citigroup. The problem with the SEC announcement yesterday is that it only applies to cases in which at the same time, the companies have admitted to or been convicted of criminal violations by in another court or by another agency. This, for example, with the Wachovia case last year, where the Department of Justice got Wachovia to admit that they had engaged in criminal wrongdoing, and the SEC still wouldn't ask them to admit criminal wrongdoing itself. So the SEC is now going to do that, but that's only a tiny fraction of the number of cases that that it actually considers. For example, the Citigroup case doesn't fall into that at all because it's a civil case. So it's a step in the right direction, but it's a very small step that affects almost very few of the cases that the SEC considers.
And it's still going to allow these companies that have not been subject to a criminal case to hide or to not. It's not going to allow the judge to see what the actual evidence is against these companies and to rule on the evidence. They can only rule on the settlement.
All right. Moving on to international and Syria.
Yeah, an explosion in Syria yesterday, a bomb killing 26 people in Damascus. This coming after another bomb just before Christmas killed 44 and 35 people killed yesterday in protests on the usual Friday of protests. Now, the bombs are particularly significant because, as we've talked about on this show, the protests in Syria have been becoming increasingly violent. But a lot of people are thinking that the bombs were actually placed there by the government in order to discredit the opposition and claim that they're becoming increasingly violent as well. All of this adds up to the fact that the observers that are on the scene from the Arab League have done virtually nothing to stem the increasing violence and the increasing repression of the government that's been taking place. And so a lot of people both inside and outside Syria are calling more and more for the United Nations to step in and take some kind of action. One of the biggest impediments to that so far, of course, is that the United States has not been willing to put its diplomatic muscle behind putting any kind of pressure on Syria in the way it did, for example, in Libya or at the end against Egypt or Tunisia.
So, or even what it's doing against Iran with enormous and very tight sanctions.
Yeah, and there have been some developments in Iran also, which we'll talk about next week. But it's been very discouraging to see more and more innocent people dying in Syria. It's literally been thousands at this point over the last 10 months, and the United States still not lifting a finger when it mobilized its military and NATO to help with the concern about concerns that turned out to be unverified about the killing of civilians in Libya. We know the civilians are being killed in Syria, and nothing's being done.
And we know from human rights groups that thousands are being held in prisons there and are being subject to torture, and the United States is still not doing anything. We can muster lots and lots of press coverage, and we can muster lots of diplomatic muscle to put sanctions against Iran because they're developing a nuclear fuel rod, even though we have no evidence yet that they're developing a nuclear weapon. But we can't get our acts together to make a push against Syria when it's killing and torturing thousands of its own civilian population.
Of course, part of the dynamic of that is that the government of Israel really dislikes the government of Iran, and it's just hunky-dory with the dictatorship in Syria.
Yeah, Syria is, after all, considered a stable government by Washington, D.C. and by Israel. Who knows what might take its place if we allow democracy to flourish there?
Heaven forbid.
All right. Well, moving on, we're now going to get Maria's anticipated financial trends.
Yeah, I did this last year.
We should mention, yes, that your record last year was exceptionally good.
Yeah, I did that last year where I talked about what I thought were going to be the big stories of 2011 in terms of the economy. And it turns out that just about every single one of them on my list of six or seven was indeed kind of dominated the news. Or if it didn't dominate the news, it was a big issue that year.
And it should have dominated the news.
And it should have dominated the news. So I just wanted to kind of do a little brainstorming and then talk about what I think are going to be the big issues for the economy in 2012. And I think at the top of the list should be that unless unemployment improves, we can expect to see more street protests when the weather warms up here. So the Occupy Wall Street movement, although it went away as the weather grew colder and police tactics coordinated up in cities around the United States, I think we're going to see something like it happen again this year. Number two on my list is that lack of funding for state and local governments is going to lead to some serious problems with basic services. We were just talking about that in terms of school funding, that the courts are having to step in here in the state of Washington to try to ensure basic funding for a basic education that should be assigned to people, that cuts in state and local government are getting not just down to the bone, but we're cutting away bone at this point. We're going to see problems with roads, I think, health services, you know, food banks and shelters and a lot of other things that we take for granted.
Yeah, and that aren't constitutionally guaranteed the way education is. And so they're actually even more vulnerable in Washington state to these kind of cuts than education is. So we're going to see a lot of that over the next year.
And I think it's going to be more than just here in the state of Washington.
Oh, absolutely.
It's going to be places like California, in Florida, places where the economic downturn has been the worst. But it's going to be nationwide. Number three on my list is that interest rates will continue to stay low, but prices will continue to rise. Now, the Fed, which sets interest rates for the nation, has said that they're going to keep interest rates low at near zero until at least the middle of 2013. And there are economists and other folks pushing them to say, to make a commitment to keep interest rates low at least through 2014. But on the other hand, commodities are becoming scarce. Certain commodities are becoming scarce, including oil and certain food items are becoming harder to come by and becoming more expensive. So you're going to see a disconnect between what is considered the official inflation rate, that is the interest rate that the Fed sets and the interest rates that banks and credit card companies and so forth charge for making loans, and real prices and the rise in real prices for things like gasoline and food and shelter. Now, not necessarily housing prices, but rent has been going up because there's a shortage of rental properties for the people getting kicked out of the houses they bought at and needing rental space. And so rent has gone up. So these things are, there's going to be a disconnect between the official inflation rate and what people will be perceiving as the actual prices that they pay for items.
Yeah, and we've also seen this disconnect in the consumer price index in terms of things that are calculated in calculating inflation, that housing is not included, foodstuffs are not accounted. The things that have been going up, the commodities that have been scarce, fuel is not included in that, are exactly the things that are not counted or calculated.
Pitching out the things that matter when they talk about inflation. And I think it's a sign that things are unraveling systemically when you've got the official inflation rate doesn't match the real inflation of goods. And so number four, five, and six are all things that are continuations of the past year. I think we can expect Congress to do not much of anything in terms of the economy when this is the turning point. It's time for the government to step forward and say, we got to do a jobs program. We got to talk about how we can help pull the economy back up. But Congress is at a standstill in terms of what Republicans and Democrats can agree on. And we can expect them to stay that way, I think, through most of this next year. Number five is we can expect things to worsen in the European debt crisis because Western Europe has to refinance hundreds of billions of dollars in debt within the next 4 to 6 months. And the credit markets are not looking good for that. And number six is we can expect fraud and risky practices to continue in the U.S. housing market and the financial industry as a whole because Republicans have been extremely obstructionist when it comes to helping fund the regulatory bodies that were set up by the Dodd-Frank Act to try to prevent this risky business, just like we talked about earlier. And then number seven on my list is that and I like to kind of round out the list by talking about something that is more hopeful rather than just looking at the crappy state of the economy as a whole.
Just for the novelty of it.
Just for the novelty of it. Number seven on the list is I think we have to look towards local efforts to start small community businesses or cooperative businesses, and in particular looking at community or cooperative or local banks. And in this item, I want to talk a little bit about a state bank that may be forming here in Washington. I think that's a very good idea. The idea being that a state bank or a local bank can take the money that people deposit into it and loan it out locally to smaller businesses and to groups who are doing good things in the community instead of just sitting on it or investing it in derivatives or in the stock market or in currency trading or whatever the big national banks invest in.
Now, I would also add, in terms of local community endeavors, that food endeavors that are locally based, CSAs and organic growers and whatnot, should continue to grow in the next year. And that's also a very encouraging sign.
Yeah, and it'll be interesting. I'd like to see more people step forward and say, well, you know, the big multinational corporations have pretty much wrecked the economy. And a lot of big businesses provide you, a lot of big retailers provide you cheap crap made abroad. But there's a space for local companies to get involved in doing things that are quality things. I think people are willing to open their wallets now and spend the little money they have if they think they're going to get a quality product, particularly if it's made locally. And I'd like to see some local businesses come forward and do that. It'd be nice to see them set themselves up in an alternative way as cooperative businesses as well. And this may be the year when people start asking, what is a cooperative? How does it work? Can we get one going?
And what do you think about the concept of local currencies and or, you know, barter systems?
Well, I don't know about local currencies. I know barter systems can work very well in local communities, and that a lot of them have been going for many, many years.
Yeah,
and the internet is making it a little bit easier for some of that stuff to get going, not just on a local basis, but nationally or regionally.
Yeah, the places where local currencies have worked well tend to be smaller communities than Seattle, places like Ithaca, New York, places that are a little more homogenous. But it's certainly an issue that's worth looking at.
Yeah, and I'd encourage people to start researching some of that stuff, start looking into it and seeing if maybe you can get involved in doing some of that.
All right. So that's your predictions for 2012?
Yeah.
All right.
What about the Mayan apocalypse? Do you think that's going to kick in? And...
I don't pay too much attention to that kind of stuff.
Oh,
I'm not an expert.
Not an expert on that one. All right. Events.
Okay. Let's see. Starting in about a half hour at 9:30, going to 2:30 this afternoon, there's going to be a legislative workshop previewing the state legislative session that starts on Monday by leading environmental groups talking about environmental issues that'll be considered or not considered in this year's session. It's $10 without lunch, $20 including lunch. It'll be at 120 Kane Hall on the UW campus. Also today at 3 o'clock, the Green Party is hosting a fundraiser for Mothers for Police Accountability, an outstanding group that's been doing a lot of work around trying to hold the SPD accountable for many, many years. Mm-hmm. That's being hosted by Joe Swiat in the Ravenna neighborhood at 2021 Northeast 75th Street. Stop on by and pitch in some money for a great group. On Wednesday, January 11th, it's the 10th anniversary, as I mentioned, of the Guantanamo Bay facility opening. There will be a candlelight vigil at the federal building at 5 o'clock, that's at 2nd and Madison, to protest indefinite detention, torture, and Obama's signing, as I mentioned, of the National Defense Authorization Act. Also on Wednesday from 7 to 9 o'clock at the Finney Neighborhood Center, the Lower Brick Building at 67th and Finney, author Charles Eisenstein will be talking on sacred economics, putting people and community first, as we were just talking about. And then on Saturday, get an early start for this one, which is why I'm mentioning it a week ahead. 9 a.m. will be the start of a weekend of MLK Day activities, the annual events there at the Ground Zero Center for Nonviolent Action in Polsbo at 16159 Clear Creek Road, just across from the Bangor Nuclear Subbase.
And they have info at their website, gzcenter.org.
That is correct.
Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish and Maria Tomchuk, both with Eat the State. And where do people find Eat the State?
You can find Eat the State at www.eatthestate.org. Maria's Economic Stories of 2011 are on the site right now, and we're rolling out the others in the next couple of days, too, so check it out.
Yeah, and I've also been posting some of my articles on my own website, mariatomchuk.com, so you can check them out there, too.